everyone, and welcome to another episode of our podcast, Experience Community, powered by Northeastern University Advancement. As always, I am your host, Diane McGilvray, and I want to thank you so much for listening in. New episodes of our podcast will drop every other week, and we're going to be bringing you some insight into Northeastern's Advancement Division, our wonderful colleagues, interesting conversations, stories about how we got here, thoughts about what comes next, and we are even thinking about mixing up the format a little bit and hearing even more from many, many of you. So please, please give us your feedback. Let us know the topics you want to cover, who you want to hear from, and how this can be most useful to you as we do our work and get to know one another better, gearing up for what is going to be the October launch, public launch, of our next campaign. I am so excited to welcome today's guest, Camille Klutz-Leach, who is our board secretary. One of the reasons I'm really excited about this, Camille, is when I was thinking about this podcast, you were one of the people that I had in mind
because
you joined us during COVID. And I don't know how many people have had a chance to meet you in person. I hope lots. But you have one of the most interesting stories because you simply love education. So just by way of a little bit of context, Camille comes to us from North Carolina, and she was at Winston-Salem State, where she filled a whole lot of roles, and we're going to get into that in a minute. She has her bachelor's degree from Wake Forest, double major, very Northeastern-like, even though it wasn't at Northeastern, to study two different fields. Juris Doctor from North Carolina Central, and Camille just completed very recently her PhD. So you've got a lot of degrees.
I do.
Tell us, where did this love of education come from?
My family. So, like, my dad's a teacher. Several members of my family are in the educational arena. And, you know, coming up in the 70s, education was just something that was always important to Black middle class families as a way to continue to progress. And so education was just always there. It was always around me. And it wasn't necessarily, one thing about me, it's not necessarily like structured education, even though I find myself in these structural places for education. It is just about learning in general, right? I just really love to learn. I like new topics, new things, new people. Just a learner at heart. So, but I think it was beat into by my parents.
So when you were studying, I think your degrees are in psychology and sociology.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know you wanted to go on and get the JD? Did you know you wanted to be a lawyer?
No, never. So from the age of 5 until organic chemistry, what was that, about 20? I wanted to be an obstetrician, gynecologist, and deliver babies. So I really thought I was going to medical school. That was my life's plan. Well, that was my plan. And the goal, however, I ran into organic chemistry and thought maybe there's something else I should be doing with my life. And in a just series of life events, conversations with my uncle, my dad, my best friend's mom. I didn't have high school debate, but I always had a mouth, right? So I'm, you know, talking to friends now about their precocious children, kind of remembering my own precociousness as a child. And but I always had like the gift of gab. And my uncle would say to my dad, like, you can't argue with her. And I was having a debate with my best friend's mom, and she said, oh, you have the mouth of a lawyer. Well, lawyer, that was like an insult, I thought. So I asked her, is this an insult or a compliment? And she's like, take it as a compliment. And it kind of planted a seed. I did know that, you know, with psychology and sociology, I was going to have to get an advanced degree. But the story of law school is I literally was debating on whether or not I was going to get a PhD in sociology or go to law school. So I sat in my apartment, said a prayer, and flipped a coin. That's really how it happened. I just flipped the coin and said a prayer and said, okay, well, it landed on heads. I'm going to apply for law school and take the LSAT. And that's what happened. Like, there was no magical moment of, oh, I want to be a lawyer. I want to be the next Johnny Cochran or Supreme Court Justice. No, it was never in my pathway, although it was in my pathway. So it's almost like things come full circle.
Your experience in law school, was it what you expected, given that you hadn't really thought, you know, from the age of, you know, 5 or 10, law is what I want to do?
Law school taught me survival. It was literally the hardest thing I've ever done. And so when I'm mentoring young students and they're talking about, oh, I want to go to law school, I always ask about why. Like, there has to be a heart-driven why, because it's not the money, fame, power that you see on TV. And if you don't have the tenacity and the will to be there, you're not going to make it through law school. Like, it was, if you didn't have a spiritual place, law school will make you find a spiritual place. Much harder than the PhD program. Much harder.
That's really interesting. And then your path after law school, you didn't start in higher administration, did you?
No, I didn't know. You know, it's funny because when I was younger and people would ask, like, are you going to be a teacher? Are you going into education? I was like, never. I'm not going to do it. But I also didn't know that lawyers existed in higher education spaces. And so I found myself at a crossroad in life where I am with my first child, pregnant with my first child, but I'm making this commute into a rural space. And my husband's like, please don't drive there. And this was before the technology we have today. Mm-hmm. So cell phone signals would not work. So he was afraid I would find myself on this isolated part of a rural place and no cell service and pregnant. So he said, can't you just get another job? Sure, there are 30 million, I can just find one. But I apply for a job that's posted at North Carolina A&T State University as an agency legal specialist. And I read it and it's about contract and employment, and I dabbled in all those things and had the background. I was like, I think I could do this. I walk into the space and realized the working title is assistant legal counsel, where nobody told me that. I thought it was gonna be behind the scenes, kind of doing contract paper pushing work, but it wasn't. And that, I think, is where I had that introduction into law and higher education and what the role that law plays in education, and found my love for education mm-hmm. in a different way. And once I got into higher ed law, I stayed. Like, I turned down corporate opportunities along the way. I actually had an offer to be a corporate attorney to do international contracts, right? And they told me what my countries would be. And I turned it down, and my husband was like, are you crazy? It's like, no, I think I found, like, the space where I'm supposed to be, and this space gives me purpose in a mm-hmm. lot of different ways. And so I'm kind of stuck in higher ed at this point.
And that happened to you a few times, I think, along the way, where you walked into a job and then it ended up being
something totally different.
Something totally different and more.
Yeah. The same thing, like, from the assistant legal counsel position, I found myself in the general counsel position before the age of 30. And, you know, everyone knows that North Carolina A&T is, like, the biggest HBCU in the nation. But it was just, I kind of fell into it because the head attorney had been injured and was out on leave. And then she chose to leave because she just wasn't doing as well physically as she wanted to do. And so I found myself in that space. Now I have this huge job that also now encompasses not only the legal pieces, but I was logo, license, and trademark director. I was the government relations person. It was just a whole host of other jobs that came along with the pathway, but the learner in me loves a challenge. So I was like, I think I could do it. I can figure it out, and had a great time figuring it out along the way.
And then when did you first start working in the governance context? You are Northeastern's board secretary.
You know, when I look back, that started probably, it started before higher ed. And when I was the staff attorney for, I'm giving all these shout outs to Montgomery County Social Services. When I was their staff attorney, part of my role was working with their board. And so, you know, it just kind of happened along the way, but it started then. So that was probably 3 years out of law school, started working with boards.
So, because you are absolutely one of the most creative people I've worked with in understanding how governance is just absolutely critical for good functioning institutions of any size, but also understanding that boards are made up of people, institutions are made up of people. So you have bylaws, you have, you know, operating procedures, but you're also trying to empower and enable the mission. So how, you know, a lot of lawyers are not as
Flexible?
Flexible. And I'm not meaning to suggest, you know, we bend things. What I mean is that where did you really get that ability to kind of think of mission first rather than statute first?
I think it's just how I'm wired. I think it comes from, like, the idea of solving problems, right? My kids get on me because I say, oh, it's like a puzzle. Everything's like a puzzle. It's like, no, Mom, it's not a puzzle. Everything's not a puzzle. But I do think that a lot of things in life are kind of around that puzzle idea, and you try to figure out where things go. And oftentimes we see the rules and we're restricted by the rules. My perception is the rule provide the boundaries, but there are different things that we can do within the rules to get us to solving the problem. So it's really for me about problem solving. How can I solve the problem that's been presented within the constraints that I have, instead of relying on the constraints to say I can't solve the problem? So it's kind of backwards.
Hi, podcast listeners. We're going to take a brief break to make sure you know about this year's Networked for Life ceremony. We're excited to be back in person as we recognize those who have made a massive impact through volunteer leadership at Northeastern. The event is Friday, May 6th at 10:30 a.m. in Isaac. It'll also be live streamed on the Advancement website. That's advancement.northeastern.edu/networkedforlife. See you on Friday. Now, back to the podcast with Diane and Camille.
So you were at Winston-Salem State serving as chief of staff, board secretary,
vice chancellor,
doing all kinds of things. And then you decide you're going to embark on a PhD at the same time.
Actually, I thought about the PhD, and I think it's because, you know, if you go back to my story, I flipped a coin. Right. And the coin kind of drove what the decision was instead of an innate desire. The desire for the PhD was always there. And it may be from hearing the horror stories of my dad, who's ABD from Florida State. But he ran into a health problem and couldn't finish his dissertation. And so we always knew that he was ABD. But it was probably started at North Carolina A&T. And it was right around, where was it around? Anywho, regardless of that. One of the things that kind of drove me to think about the PhD was I started the application process when I was at North Carolina A&T, and I put it down because I thought, well, I need to prepare for the GRE, I need to get a good score, I need to take the test, do all these practices, and so I put it away. And then I hit this place in life where it is either you're going to do it or you're not going to do it, because it kind of just pulled on me a little bit. So I went in to do an application, and my old application was on file. Everything was the same except an address and a GRE score. And so as with the LSAT and everything else, I flipped the coin, said a prayer, and was like, Lord, bless this GRE. And you know, the score is going to be what it is, and I'll use my other skills to kind of bolster my application. So I started school when I was at Winston-Salem State, but I actually started the application process and desire while I was at North Carolina A&T about 3 years, 3 to 4 years before that.
And what is your field?
I have a Doctor of Philosophy in Education. I have to say it like that now. I'm a JD, PhD.
Right,
I have
exactly.
To change the tone of my voice.
Very serious. Very, very.
Not at all. A lot of
gravitas. I thought when you were sharing with me the topic of your dissertation that it was really fascinating and needs to be a book. But as we were talking about that, you were literally finishing the dissertation, and
yeah,
that needed to come first. Do you mind sharing with the division?
So it's a long title. So the title of my dissertation is The Code of Silence, The Impact of Cultural Barriers on Reporting Acts of Sexual Victimization for Black Women at HBCUs. And so we're going to take up all the time if we start talking about my dissertation project. But a quick snippet is from my experiences as an attorney in some sectors. Like when I was at A&T, I was part of certain processes where I saw the sexual assault pieces come through. And same is true for Winston-Salem State, because I was also the vice chancellor over both HR and Title IX EEO. And so I saw things come through. What I started to see was a pattern. And with in my own experiences as a Black woman, what I also started to understand was, I think there's something in our culture that has an impact on these reporting or lack of reporting. And if so, what is it? And started to dig deep into that and landed on a few factors that kind of rose to be the cultural barriers. And that included, one, the code of silence. Like in the Black community, there is the, I'm gonna call it the proverb, what goes on in this house stays in this house. And I tested it on several of my friends from different races and backgrounds. And I said, what goes on in this house? And they looked at me like, you're looking at me, Diane. What goes on in this house? But if I say that to any of my Black female friends, they automatically knew what the trigger was. What goes on in this house stays in this house. And that gets replicated in a lot of ways in a lot of conversations. And so silence became the big impact of all of it. And we find silence. I found silence replicated in my study, both in hip hop, right, in terms of the language and the quiet and the perpetuation of the ride or die female side chick, for lack of a better word, to always be quiet, right, to always be quiet. And I started seeing that, and that is just a little snippet of my dissertation. You asked about the book when I just written 200 pages, right. And my eyes were burning, but I do think that there is a place for the conversation as well as the potential impact and resources so that we can eradicate the silence around sexual victimization. And it's found everywhere, not just in Black culture, but for me, that was what was pulling me. Why am I seeing these patterns and trends when there's a whole video now of what just happened, but there's silence, right? There's also a piece, particularly on Black colleges, where Black men are deemed to be endangered species. And so the women feel that they're going to get an extra layer of protection that the reporting victim is not going to get. So it's a whole host of things. But also in the middle of my dissertation is a critical race theory policy analysis of the Title IX regulations and the implications that the current regulations, although they're undergoing changes now, have on Black women specifically, or could potentially have on Black women. And one of those things where we talk about, if you think about the code of silence, one of the new regulations requirements was formal reporting, right? Not the university or someone could know and launch an investigation, but actual formal reporting. Mm-hmm. Well, I just told you in page 12 of my dissertation, Black women don't report to police. So you're not going to, that's going to have a drastic implication on whether or not reporting increases or decreases. So it was really fun to do. It really was fun. It was just a lot of writing.
Right. Well, I also think it's interesting because where we started this conversation, when you were talking about, you know, why law school, why law, and having a voice and wanting to use that voice, that one of the, you know, arguably most important things that you've done in terms of your, you know, academic intellectual life is to try to break that silence and to provide a voice for things that are unsaid. So I think that's, you know, amazing. I'm in awe. And so you do divide your time. Currently, you're up here and you have a wonderful little place, I guess, in the Fenway, and your family, you have two sons.
Yes, I do.
We talked about when you finally finished that dissertation. Do you get to go home when you're here in your place in Boston and just read for fun for the first time in, oh, I don't know, your adult life?
I'm still tired. So I do have my stack of books kind of lined up, but I haven't picked them up to start reading again yet for fun. Partly because parts of my mind are still kind of wired around that dissertation and whether or not there's anything else I'm going to do with it. My sister is also currently a PhD student, and so she's always trying to rope me into these conferences because we presented before. And so she's like, let's go present. Like, I don't know if I want to present. So she's still kind of roping me into her space. And she actually works on a college campus. She's part of the Mall Street Partnership School at UNC Greensboro. And she keeps trying to suck me in. And I'm trying to, like, let my brain relax so I can go back to trashy novels.
Right. I was going to say, so no beach read recommendations yet from Camille.
But I will take some good book recommendations, especially like trashy novels and things that don't require critical thinking.
Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you would want, especially, you know, the division is comprised of, you know, our fundraisers, our advancement resources team, alumni relations, your fellow colleagues in the board office. What would you want them to know about what you do, what your group does, and how can we be helpful?
So we are a small team. Please know that. I think our team, the board team, is centered around servant leadership. And you will see that in how we respond, how we work together as a team, and how we respond as a collective. For us, depending on what your request is, it helps to send all emails to trustees.office@northeastern.edu. One of the things that we're trying to do, I'm process-oriented in a lot of ways, and we are trying to build an office that will be as efficient if everybody is there and if only one person is there. Like, where is the information? And so we want all information to go to trustees.office@northeastern.edu so that whether I'm checking the email or Kimberly or Raisha, we all have access to the information, because oftentimes information gets locked in one person's inbox who is now on leave, and how do I get it? And that's how things fall into the crack. And so the other thing is that we try to be very responsive, again, because we're coming from a place of service. We've checked our egos at the door. They don't really exist. So we will do whatever we're asked to do. It's not, you know, we don't really have boundaries or restrictions or limitations. So if you said, Camille, I need you to move office chairs, okay, we're on it. We will move office chairs. Because the work is about who we are as a team, as a whole. And that my people are great. Like, we have Kimberly Graves, who just joined us probably 2 months ago. And I think everybody probably knows Raisha, but just as a group, they're a great group of people to work with. And I'm excited about what we're doing and how we're going to continue to make improvements. Like, because there's so much information, it is important that we know the information. So if you have a request, again, I'm going to say, send it to trustees.office@northeastern.edu. Because we will get those. Like, someone will send Raisha an email and she's out of the office, and it has a deadline because maybe they're applying for a grant, or maybe it's some data that you need about the board related to regulatory compliance, right? If you only send it to Raisha and Raisha's out, I don't have access to Raisha's email account. So that's probably the biggest thing to know, and that we're here to help. You know, however we can help, however we can serve.
Well, that's wonderful. And Advancement Division, that seems like a pretty straightforward request from your board office. Camille Klutz-Leach, I have loved this conversation. You've inspired me to put down my trashy beach read and try to read or write something important. At least you've inspired me for right now. I know we have our meeting after this, and you're going to remind me of all the
you have homework
things that I need to do, my homework. So we will get on that. And thank you, everyone, for listening. Remember to please share any topics that you'd like us to cover, people you'd like us to speak to, you'd like to hear more from. And remember that you can download new episodes at advancement.northeastern.edu/podcast.
Before you sign off, are there room for guest presenters?
Yes, absolutely. So, room for guest presenters.
I think Amelia has been chomping at the bit.
I think Amelia is ready to host her own podcast.
I think so.
We will have to make that happen, and I'll look forward to that. She's blushing in the background.
Sorry, Amelia.
Thank you again, everyone, and look forward to seeing you soon.